the basis of all Indian philosophy, particularly the teaching of those books called the Upanishads, which are really the distilled essence of Hindu thought, the basis is called the self. And this word in Sanskrit is Atman, and that means self in the vastest possible sense and the most inclusive sense of the word. It means yourself, and it means also self as such, existence as such, the totality of all being. And, of course, this is something that one cannot talk about in the sense of talking about it logically. You can talk about it. A poet can talk about anything, and the Upanishads are very largely poetry. Of course, everything in the world, knives and forks, tables and chairs, trees and stones, are indescribable. Korzybski referred to the physical world as the unspeakable world, which was really rather a funny name, because it has two edges. It's, of course, something you can't say anything about, that is to say, it is ineffable, but it's unspeakable also in the sense of the word meaning something taboo. And we shall see as we go on wherein that taboo consists. But from the standpoint of logic, we can't say anything about everything. Because in order to say something about something and state it logically, you have to be able to put it in a class. Now, classes are intellectual boxes. Is it in, when you play games like animal, vegetable, and mineral, you've got there three boxes. And when you come to think of it, you don't know what any two of those boxes are, really, without the third, or especially you don't know any one without another. Because in order to have a box, there must be what's inside the box and what's outside the box. And then by this method of contrast, we can make a logical discussion about things. All words, therefore, are labels on intellectual pigeonholes. But then, when you come to something which is completely all-inclusive, when you come to the which therein, than which there is no witcher, to what fundamentally is, then you are without a box, and you can't talk logically. Of course, you can distinguish is from is not, but only in a very limited way, as I can say, I have a pen in my left hand, I do not have a pen in my right hand. And by this, and from this, we abstract the idea of to be and not to be, is and isn't. But when we consider being with a capital B, this includes not only such is-is as celestial bodies, but also such isn'ts as the space that encompasses them. And these two go together, as we shall see in more detail as the time goes on. But now, a perfectly logical person would therefore say that the notion of the self, the Atman, as the fundamental reality in which everything else exists, is meaningless. And, of course, from a logical point of view, it is. We won't deny that to those critics of metaphysics who call themselves logical positivists. But at the same time, just because something cannot be put into a logical category does not indicate that it isn't real. The self, you see, bears somewhat the same relationship to the world as the diaphragm of the speaker in this radio bears to the music you've just been hearing. None of the music was about the diaphragm, and nobody said anything about there being a diaphragm. The diaphragm as such didn't come into the picture, and yet it was everything in the picture. All those different noises were vibrations of this thin film of metal. So also with your eardrum, so also with the apparatus of your eyes. Your eyes, you see, have no recognizable color. I mean, you may have brown eyes or blue eyes or green eyes, but the actual lens of the eye is what we call colorless. Of course, it might have a color, only because we are seeing that color all the time, we don't notice it. Just as if you wear sunglasses, after a while you cease to notice that you've got them on. The green of the sunglass, you see, becomes the colorless color. So one might ask then, just as you say, well, what is it on? What is the music on? Is it on tape? Is it on a speaker? Is it on a drum? Whatever the variations may be. We can ask the question, what are you all on? What is all this on? And the Hindus answer, it's on the self. Like we say, this one's on me. It isn't that there's only one self in the sense that is taught in a philosophy called solipsism. Solipsism is the idea that you are the only person who exists and everybody else is your dream. Nobody can prove that this isn't so, except I'd like to see a congress of solipsists arguing as to which one of them is really there. It isn't that, it's more complex than that. It's saying that the self in each one of you is really at root one. Just in the same way that you have all over your body millions of nerve ends, each one of those nerve ends is, as it were, a little eye, because all the senses are fundamentally one sense. They are various forms of touch. And the most delicate of the forms of touch is, of course, the human eye. Then the ear, and so on down the list of the senses. Now imagine then every little nerve end is a little eye. And it gets its impression of the world, but it sends it all back into the central brain. Well, in a somewhat similar way, every person, every animal, every what the Hindus call sentient being, and even rocks are regarded as sentient beings in a very, very primitive form. Because when you say, take a piece of wood, which is supposed to be dead, or let's just take a real rock, and I go, that is the rock's response. And that indicates the rock's vibration, and that is a very, very primitive form of consciousness. The rock goes jangle all the way through and produces this noise. And that's its consciousness, right down to the lowest. So all those forms that we see may be looked upon as the eyes that look out of one central self. Only, of course, in the body, in the human body, we can see the connections between the nerve ends and the brain. It's much more difficult to see the connection between one individual and another. If they're married, that's a little bit closer. But just all us human beings rattling around, we're not even rooted to the ground like trees. And therefore it's very easy for us to form the impression that I am only what is inside my bag of skin. And that my ego, myself, is a different self from yourself. And we're all, therefore, fundamentally disconnected. Now that, of course, is a superstition. It is an idea brought into us by our upbringing and by our various cultures. Because actually, from a perfectly physical point of view, not talking anything about metaphysics, no person exists alone. Or as the poet Donne put it, no man is an island. You exist, each one of you, strictly courtesy of your parents. And we need, in order to live, the cooperation of a community, of a society, not only of people, but also of plants, many kinds of animals, insects, bacteria, air, temperature, cosmic rays, every kind of thing that is around us is as essential to our being as our heads. You can draw little gradations of some things that are more essential and some things that are less essential. But fundamentally, everything is necessary for your existence. And so your apparent disconnection, the fact that you are not tied to other people with umbilical cords or some kind of wiring that gives you one mind. Nevertheless, we do have one mind. In the sense that, for example, all of us turn out to be approximately the same shape. Two eyes, two nostrils, a mouth, two hands, two legs, and so on. A haiku poem, a Japanese haiku, says 100 gourds from the mind of one vine. And so it is with people. And so it is with everything in the world. That's just from a purely physical point of view. But going yet deeper, we find that it's somehow a necessity of thought that there be some sort of a something which is the common ground of all these universes, all these galaxies. And that ground is the self, as Hindus understand it, the Atman. Now that's quite a startling point of view. Because what it's saying is, you see, that you are basically the works. Now, the Hindus do say that the self, the great self, is consciousness. But of course, that does not mean consciousness in the sense of our ordinary everyday consciousness. Ordinary everyday consciousness is indeed a form of this kind of consciousness, shall we say, a manifestation of it. But naturally, you see, you have going on all the time two types of consciousness. Number one, the things you notice. And you notice things by having words or other symbols which you attach to them. It's very difficult to notice a thing for which you don't have a name and which you can't classify by some sort of image or shape. There are peoples, of course, who notice things that we don't notice. Eskimos have five different words for snow, because snow is very important to them, and to us it's all just plain snow. Hopis have words for dry space, which is we don't have one word for that. There are all kinds of variations in language according to what people notice. So there's noticing consciousness, which we have courtesy of notation. But then there's also consciousness which doesn't notice, but nevertheless is highly responsive. You are responding at the moment to all kinds of stimuli coming to your nerve ends, which you don't notice at all. The way you are sitting is a response to unconscious stimuli. The way you adjust yourself and move, the way your heart beats, the way you breathe, the way you grow your hair, the way you color your eyes, the way you see. You don't know how you do that. You're doing it, but you don't know how it's done. So you see, consciousness in the ordinary sense, that is, say, conscious attention, doesn't notice everything. It only notices very little of the world. If I ask you, what did you do yesterday? You will give me a story, which you will write out in words or say in words, and you will stretch that out in a long, thin line. and it will be a very, very attenuated and abstract form of what in fact you did yesterday. Because you did billions of things yesterday, but you remember only a very few of them, because you only noticed a very few. So, therefore, just in the same way that conscious attention is not aware of all the other operations of the body, so, in just that way, we are not aware of our connection, indeed our identity, with the fundamental self. We go to sleep at night, and then we wake up, and because the physical brain is still there, we remember everything that happened the day before. But if the physical brain decomposes, then we're what is called dead. And we say, well, that's the end of that. But when the leaves die and fall off the trees, or the fruit drops, next year, more leaves, more fruit. So in the same way, when you and I die, more babies later. If the whole human race dies, you bet your life. There are all kinds of things that feel that they're human, scattered throughout the multiplicity of galaxies. Because this universe is a peopling universe, just as an apple tree apples. But because we are unconscious of the intervals, we are not aware of the self with our conscious attention when conscious attention isn't operating. But still, just as you don't notice what your pineal gland, say, is doing at the moment, so in the same way, you don't notice the connections which underlie, which tie us all together, not only here and now, but forever and ever and ever and ever. The difficulty and the basic reason why we don't notice the self is that the self doesn't need to look at itself. A knife doesn't need to cut itself. Fire doesn't need to burn itself. Water doesn't need to quench itself. And a light doesn't need to shine on itself. So, this is the fundamental problem of having some sort of awareness of the self. Nevertheless, it is the whole contention of Indian philosophy, especially what we call Vedanta, that it is possible, in a certain way, to become aware of oneself in this deepest sense, to know that you are the totality. And this experience is the real substance of Indian philosophy as a whole, both Hindu and Buddhist. It is called moksha, which roughly means liberation. Liberation from the hallucination that you are just poor little me. To wake up from that kind of hypnosis and discover that you are simply something, your organism, your physical body, your conscious attention, which is your ego, that you are something being done by this vast, indescribable self, which is out of time, which has no beginning, no end, neither continues nor discontinues. It's beyond all categorization whatsoever. And so the Upanishads say, all we can say of it positively is the negative. Neti, neti, it is not this, it is not that. Anything, therefore, you can formulate, imagine, picture, will not be the self. So when you are trying to know the self, you have to get rid of every idea in your head. It doesn't mean, as some people seem to think, that you have to get rid of every sense impression. It isn't as if you had to go into a catatonic state of total absorption. Of course, that can be done. But the full moksha, the full liberation, is when you come back out of absorption and see this everyday world just as it looks now, but see as clearly can be, that it is all the self. It is comparable to something like this. If you look at the moon, you might imagine at full moon that you were looking at a disk, until somebody points out to you that it's a ball. Now, nothing in the way of a sense impression has changed, but your understanding of it has changed radically. Sunrise is not the same event for a person who thinks that the Earth is the center of the solar system as it is for a person who knows that the Sun is the center of the solar system and that the Earth is turning. The senses see the same event, but there is a different interpretation. And so more is seen. Seeing is done much more with the mind than with the eye. We see what we are taught to see. We see in terms of our ideological structure, our culture, our conditioning. And so all that conditioning teaches us to see the world in its separateness. But you can be deconditioned from that and see just this same world that you're looking at now in its unity. There are a few hints that I can give right now as to how that happens. Only I shall go into this much more fully in the last session. You must understand, right to begin with, that when we talk of things, people, and houses, and waters, and mountains, that thinking about them that way emphasizes their difference. It stresses differentiation. But you see, you don't really know what differentiation is unless you know what sameness is. Just as you don't know what to be is unless you know the meaning of not to be. And the boundaries of things which outline them, and we say, well, I begin maybe up here, and above my head it's not me anymore. So this cranium thing, the skull with hair on top of it, divides me from space. True, if you want to look at it that way. But it's equally true that my cranium joins me to space. Imagine what would happen to me if there weren't any space around me. My outline would thereupon disappear. Because you see, every boundary needs two sides, the inside and the outside. And you can't separate them. So boundaries are held in common. They join things as much as they divide them. Now, we are taught, you see, not to see that way. Our conscious attention is captured by figures within backgrounds, and it tends to ignore backgrounds. It is captured by things that move rather than things that are relatively still. And so when we see someone going up a hill, we say the man is going up the hill. We don't see also that the hill is coming down to the man. If you really know how to climb hills, you will feel the hill lifting you up as you climb. And that will make climbing much easier. Every pull is also a push, and every push is also a pull. When I put my hand out like that, it is correct to say that it is pulled out as that I push it out. You can see that easily in turning the steering wheel of a car. Are you pulling it or pushing it? Both. So, you can become aware of this tremendous interconnectedness of everything. And that is one aspect, one fragment of what somebody who is moksha, who is liberated, sees. He sees, shall we say, that everything goes together. And that is, in a way, what we mean by relativity. Because relativity means relatedness. Just as fronts go with backs and tops with bottoms, insides with outsides, solids with spaces, so everything that there is goes together. And it makes no difference whether it lasts a long time or whether it lasts a short time. A galaxy goes together with all the universe just as much as a mosquito, which has a very short life. From the standpoint of the self, time is completely relative. You can have, if you scale it down, as much time between two of those very rapid drum beats as you can in eons and eons and eons. It's all a question of point of view, or, to use a scientific expression, level of magnification. Change your magnification on your skin, take out a magnifying glass, and you don't see the familiar skin anymore. You see all the pores with hairs sticking out of them. Change it again and get a microscope, and you see cellular structure. Get an ion microscope, and you see molecules. And we know by other methods of observation that it can get smaller and smaller and smaller, and that the spaces between these minute units are so vast that they're comparable to the distances between the sun and the planets in scale. So also with time. So in this sense, there could be vast, vast universes full of empires and battleships and palaces and brothels and restaurants and orchestras in the tip of your fingernail. And on the other hand, we could be all going on in the tip of somebody else's fingernail. It's very important to understand not only the relativity of size and of time, but also of what there is. Now, as you know, the human senses respond only to a very small band of the known spectrum of vibrations. We know through instruments of quite a vast spectrum, but we, as I say, with our senses, see only a little of it. If our senses were in some way altered, we would see a rather different looking world. We can do this, of course. We can put on special lenses to enable us to see heat. And then we see all the heat radiations coming out of people. And we say, well, I never noticed that about you before. But so in the same way, you see, there are infinitely many possibilities of vibration and of organs sensitive to those vibrations, so that there could be worlds within worlds within worlds, spaces within spaces, just like the many, many wavelengths of radio and television going on forever and ever in all directions. The possibilities are infinite. But having senses and noticing is a selective process. It picks out only certain ones, just as when you play the piano. You don't take both arms and slam down all keys at once. You select. And so perception is a kind of piano playing. It is picking out certain things as significant, that is to say, as constituting patterns. And the whole universe seems to be a process of playing with different patterns. But whatever it does, whatever it plays, in whatever dimension, on whatever scale of time or space, it's all on the self. And the self is also known in Sanskrit as Brahman. This is a neuter word. Brahman is from the root BRH, br, which means to expand, to grow. It isn't quite clear exactly why this word was chosen. Sometimes there's a still better word for the self, which I like, is the word tat. Almost like tit for tat. Tat. Tat means that. We get our word that from the Sanskrit tat. And so when the baby comes into being, first of all, the first thing it says is da. Da. The baby is pointing. Da, da, da. And it's saying that. Look, isn't that marvelous? That, you see? So that is the witch than which there is no witcher. And so you get the formula in this Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Tat tvam asi. Which means, tat, that, tuam, Latin, you know, you, asi, are. You are that. Or that thou art. That art thou. So, in this sense then, every self is modeled on and is an expression of the one self, because you all feel individually that you're the center of the world. And everything else is seen in circles, circling out, sphering out from where you are. And that's, as it were, the called the microcosm, the little cosmos. But then in the same way, the macrocosm has a central self, although this is not central in the way we talk about centers in space. Do you see that? A center of a circle is in the middle of the circle, and the circumference is away from it. But you could say, you could use a phrase that the Christian theologians have used of God, that circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. You could speak of Brahman that way. It isn't in the middle of the universe, spatially speaking. You might ask the question, where is the universe? Ever thought of that one? Where is it? Well, you can't say where, because everywhere has to be in relation to something. There would have to be another universe to say where this one is. But then, since those two together would constitute the universe, we wouldn't still be able to say where it was. It isn't anywhere. And so in that sense, the center isn't anywhere in space locally. And furthermore, the kind of space we are dealing with is only one possible kind of space. It's the kind of space our physical organisms are attuned to. We are, you see, like the radio. We pick up what wavelength we're on. So then, when inquirers used to come to that great modern Hindu saint, Sri Ramana Maharshi, and they'd ask him all sorts of silly questions, like, who was I in my last incarnation? What will I be in my next one? he would always reply, "Who is asking the question? Who are you? Find out, because that's the thing you need to know." As it were, dig down into the depths of your being and say, "What is this that I call I?" That's one of the very fascinating questions. It's also, it teases us out of thought to think about death in the sense of going to sleep and never waking up. Imagine that. And you find you can't. And yet, it's a thought that, although you can't get to grips with it, it remains fascinating. Also the question, how is it suddenly that you awakened into this world? Where were you before? In Zen Buddhism, they have the meditation problem, the koan. Before your father and mother conceived you, what is your original nature? And that's the same sort of weird question as what it would be like to go to sleep and never wake up. What was it like to wake up having not previously gone to sleep? It's very mysterious. But as you go on and plumb this question, you begin to develop the feeling that your existence is exceedingly odd. In many ways odd. Odd because it is here and it so easily might not have been. After all, if your father hadn't met your mother, would you be here? Now, of course, somebody would be here, because he might have met somebody else. Would that be you? Of course it would. Don't you see? You can only be you by being someone. But every someone is you. Every someone is I. That's your name, you say. It's me. I am here. And everybody feels that I, in the same way. It's the same feeling, just like blue everywhere is the same color. So I-ness being, as it were, the most fundamental thing in man is also fundamental to the universe. It too is I. And our I is a special case of it. Coming out from the, in quotes, central eye, like so many tits from the belly of a sow, or so many spines from a sea urchin, so many legs from a spider. And that is, of course, why the images of the Hindu gods are shown with many arms or many faces, because it is saying that all arms are the arms of the divinity, all faces are its masks. So, you see, there's really nothing to worry about. Because the important you is perfectly indestructible. It's what there is. Now, of course, a Hindu like Krishnamurti would say, you must be very careful about beliefs like that, because you may be using this idea of an eternal self, which is the real self in you, as an escape, as an expression of your fear of ceasing to be. And indeed, most beliefs are used in that way. People commonly say, I need a religion because I need something to hang on to. Now, if you need something to hang on to, you have not got religion. Because you've got the opposite of faith. Faith is not a state of hanging on to something. Faith is a state of letting go. So you see, lots of people like to have a very definite idea of God. They want to be able to think of him as a benevolent old gentleman with a big beard, who's very kindly and loving, or at least some sort of spirit of the high moral character, depending on what you mean by morals. And so they believe that God is like that. But you see, the Hindus start by getting rid of beliefs. That I said, to know the self, you must get every idea out of your head about what the self could be. That doesn't mean you cease to have ideas about how to cook bread. It means that you abandon all ideas of the self, because that creates a transparent state of mind in which and through which the self can become manifest. So believing in it isn't the point. The point is knowing it. And either you know it or you don't. And when you do know it, there's no question of believing in it, because you know it. But before you know it, it doesn't really help you to believe in it. That's too bad. So you mustn't believe anything I say about the self, that is. I can, in every word, I express it, but in no word do I describe it. You see, that's the teeth can't bite themselves bit. So, this is, of course, a comforting idea in a certain sense, that our comings and goings, our fortunes and misfortunes, are a sort of mirage. As indeed they are. The more we know about them, the more we know about the world, the more diaphanous it seems. The only reason I can't push my pen through the floor is the floor is going so fast that the pen doesn't go through it. Like a revolving electric fan, you have some difficulty putting your finger through, and if you persist, you damage your finger. So in the same way, if you bang your head against a granite wall, you damage your head. But it's because the granite wall is going so fast. Only it's going so fast in a very small area. All those molecules are running around to beat the band. And that's why it's so strong. In sloppier things like air, it's not so fast. And so you can get through, because you're going faster than the air. So it is. But it's all something going, and if I do that fast enough, I go from, I'm still vibrating. Only you don't hear the intervals. If I do it slowly, you hear the spaces between. But make it fast enough, and the ear is trained to notice the crests of the wave of sound rather than the troughs. But it's still vibrating. Everything's vibrating. And therefore, everything in the world has the characteristics of smoke. You know, when you blow a cigarette or pipe or something, and a cloud of smoke, and you see it in the sunbeam, and it's full of whorls and designs and all kinds of marvelous things going on, and then slowly it disappears. Well, everything's just like that. So if you say, now there are two attitudes you can take to that state of affairs. You can say, sour grapes. It's all a lousy, wretched trap. And here I am, and I'm given all these feelings of love and attachment and joy of life, and then I fall apart. My teeth drop out, my eyes become feeble, I get cancer or cirrhosis of the liver or something, and then it all falls apart, and it's too bad. Therefore, don't become attached to things. Don't enjoy life. Treat it, holding it off like that, just like a very, very firm person who's been jilted and says, never again will I get mixed up with the opposite sex or with love, because love hurts. But on the other hand, a weaving of smoke can be very beautiful, provided you don't lean on it, provided you don't try to preserve it, catch hold of it. Then you destroy it. So exactly the same way, there's nothing in the way of form that you can lean on, that you can grasp. And if you see that, then the world of form is very beautiful. If you let it go, to love people, you see, if you're a husband and wife, you must let each other go. Otherwise, the marriage is either going to break up or it's going to be hell. If you love a person, you say to that person, look, I love you, whatever that may be. I've seen quite a bit of it, and I know there's lots that I haven't seen. But still, it's you, and I want you to be what you want to be. And I won't be happy if I've got you in a cage. You'd be a bird without song. So no cages around here, no balls and chains. Then, you see, they love each other, and they're likely to go on loving each other. But if they wrap each other up with all sorts of ties and chains and documents and things, then they are not on a very safe basis. The very firm words of those documents belie the situation, because nobody curses and swears and kisses the Bible and all sorts of things like that if he means yes. If there's some doubt that he means yes, then he's asked to do all these rituals of cursing and swearing, signing on dotted lines and putting the seal. Indicates doubt right at once. It just does a fly in the ointment from the beginning. So when the Hindu and Buddhist philosophers speak of detachment from all this apparent world of separate beings, some of them take a rather grim attitude about it, as if they had been jilted. But the real meaning is not to... It's not a put-down word to say that the world is a nasty thing. It's saying, really, that detachment means going with this whole thing and not resisting its change. That doesn't mean, of course, that you become totally flabby, because you wouldn't notice what change is unless there were certain interruptions in it. In other words, if a flower grew too fast, pop like that, we'd hardly notice it. It grows slowly, because there are all sorts of little tensions in it holding back. Just when you grow, or when a tree grows, the bark contains the tree and holds it in and offers a little resistance, you see. But it expands in time too. So there's always going out and holding back in change. So to go with that, though, and you can afford to go with it, you can afford to get mixed up in life and to fall in love and to get involved with all sorts of things. You can afford it if you know that it's an illusion. But this is not illusion in a bad sense of the word. Here's this Hindu word, crucial. The world is called Maya. From the root mat, this word Maya, yes, it means illusion. It means magic. It means art. It means delineation or measurement. And so from matra we get meter. We also get matter, material. Isn't it funny that when we say material, today we mean something very real, whereas the root of the word is illusion. So you see, I mean, measurement is kind of an illusion. You don't find inches lying around. You can't pick up an inch. And you can't do anything with an hour. You know, it has to be an hour of something. It has to be an inch of something. So in the same way that hours and inches and pounds and dollars and so on are actually imaginary, they're elaborate systems of cosmic bookkeeping.
with their little scratches on paper, little hairlines on dials. So, in exactly that way, the distinction between things is maya, is imaginary. But what an imagination! See? So, in a way, to say that the world is maya is at the same time to say that what lies behind maya is immaterial. Look at the reversal of the word. Oh, it's immaterial. Doesn't matter. What matters is all this. But now, that gets us to a deeper point yet. The self, the real self, doesn't matter. Which is another way of saying, it doesn't exist for any purpose. It doesn't need to exist for any purpose. What purpose would it exist for? When it's what there is. It doesn't need, won't find anything in the future. Has nothing in the past that it has to go back and remember. Is now, an eternal now. And so in that way, it doesn't matter. But therefore, the most important thing in the universe is the one thing that doesn't matter, the one thing that's totally and completely useless, and that nobody can find anything for. Once a Zen master was asked, what is the most valuable thing in the world? And he answered, the head of a dead cat. Why? Because no one can put a price on it. So this self, the Brahman, is like the head of a dead cat. But you see, if then you say, I really ought to get that dead cat's head, because something spiritual about it, and it'd be very good for me. After all, if I knew the self, I might be a better person. People might like me more. I'd be more constructive in society. I would do this, that, and the other. But you see, that's putting the cart before the horse. That's trying to make the tail wag the dog. The knowledge of Brahman, the self, never does anybody any good if they're trying to make it do them some good. Only when they're not concerned with whether it does them any good or not, does it do them any good. It's like when you relax and you go out and play. Americans in particular don't know how to do this, because they always justify it. They always say, it's good for me. It's exercise. It's a change from work, and that'll be able to make me work better. See? Everything they do is done for some serious reason. It's the Protestant conscience. And so we never play, except very exceptionally, because play is that which is done just for itself, for fun. So the self, the Atman, the Brahman, exists for fun. It has no reason to exist. It's completely useless. And it is, therefore, maya is linked with the word lila. Lila. And that means play. Also, of course, the word illusion in English is derived from the Latin ludere, to play. So the nature, you might say, of the self is that it does no work. It only plays. Work is something serious, you know, that you do for a purpose, because you believe that you've got to go on living. You work to survive, because you think you have to survive. That was one of the things they told you as a little child. You've got to go on, man.
You don't have to. This thing doesn't have to go on. That's why it does. I know that sounds paradoxical, but there's so many things in life that are like that. If I'm trying to impress people, I usually don't. If you try too hard with anything, you usually make a mess of it. You have to play it. Like when you're fishing, and you get a fish on the line, you can't just drag it out of the water. You have to play that fish, you know, gradually, like that. And so this basic thing then is that the self, the Brahman behind the world, is engaged in play. It is in this sense that the Hindu philosophers say, Brahman does not actually become the world. The meaning of that is, he's playing at being it, or it's playing at being it, as distinct from working at it. And so, in certain Oriental countries, when one refers to noble people of high birth, it is often said, so-so, Lord so-and-so has died. The Japanese would say, he has played at dying. Or will he play at taking a journey to Tokyo? So, also, remember this, although I've constantly used in this talk the word one to apply to the self, and central, the Hindus don't use this word except speaking poetically and loosely. The self is not one. The self is called non-dual. Because you see, the idea of one has an opposite. The opposite of one is many, or none. But the which than which there is no whicher has no opposite. There's nothing outside it. So you can't call it one, because one is an exclusive idea. It excludes two. So they call it, instead of one, they call it non-dual, which is Advaita. This is from the word, you see, dva is the root meaning two. It's in our, the V becomes U, so we get dual. And a is the meaning in Sanskrit often non. Non-dual, Advaita. And so it doesn't exclude anything. One is an exclusive word. Advaita is meant to be a totally inclusive kind of unity. Now, of course, this word itself, when you look at it from a logical standpoint, is a dualistic word, just like one. It's the opposite of Dvaita, Dvaita and Advaita. But the idea here in Indian philosophy is to use this word in a certain way. Now, you know that on a flat surface, you can't draw three dimensions. Anything you draw will be in two dimensions. But when we do this, we're in two dimensions. Now, if I want to put that in three dimensions, all I have to do is this. And you see a telephone pole on a road. Why? Why do we see three dimensions? Because of an artistic convention called one-pointed perspective, which will give you the illusion of a third dimension. Now, in other words, a two-dimensional line is being used to imply a third dimension which can never be expressed on a flat surface. So in exactly the same way, Advaita is a word used specially to designate what lies beyond all logical categories. perhaps the simplest way in which one can express Advaita is this. Take a piece of paper, and it clearly has two different sides. Only by the elaborate joke of the Möbius strip in mathematical topology can you make a one-sided piece of paper. But in all ordinary cases, a piece of paper has two quite different sides. But these two different sides are inseparable. You don't have one without the other. There is, therefore, shall we say, a secret conspiracy between the two sides of a piece of paper, always to be found together. Only, what is this? You see, when you get your boxes, every inside has an outside, and they go together. It's that going together that is non-duality. It expresses itself as duality, but all dualities that we know go together. And that is the non-duality that is the secret link between them.